Is this America?
Yeah.
Is this freedom?
No.
Today's news media are laden with the word freedom. The demand for human rights has stirred up political controversies over and over again. I'll be back in a moment with the amazing facts about fallacies of freedom. Hello, this is Joe Cruz of the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. You know, friends, one of the most frequent and mistaken complaints that young people make against religion is this. They say, oh, I can't have a good time and be a Christian. I have to give up so much that I can't really be happy. Now, I want us to take a long look at this complaint today, because if it's true, we may have to change our doctrines a little bit, and especially change our approach to teenagers and young people. But let me tell you something. I've talked to young people around the world and many countries of the world. I've talked to those who had experimented with every kind of fleshly indulgence in seeking after happiness. And then those young people turned around to become Christians and tasted the joy of salvation. And I have yet to hear one of those young people prefer sin over salvation. Do you know why? Because sin is as old as the hills. There's nothing new about it. In fact, sin is also the most boring thing in all the world. And this is why sinners are always rushing around so, trying to find something more exciting to do. You see, friends, it plays out very quickly because it's based entirely on emotion and passion. The pleasures of sin are short-lived. Impulse is very shallow and expends itself quickly and then leaves an aftermath of despair. This is why Satan uses feeling as one of his most fantastic weapons against young people. It's so deceptive. It can be so wonderful as a beginning, and yet so empty at the end. The devil's not concerned, of course, about the future. He wants you to forget it and just live for the present. Live for today. He wants you to keep finding present excitement instead of thinking about the day of accounting that's just before all of us. Now in Hebrews 11, 24 and 25, we find the experience of Moses. And this is what we read. And by faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Now, friends, notice that there are pleasures in sin. Moses admitted it, but they're only for a season, he said. Just remember that. Few realize, of course, what Moses had to give up in order to follow God. What courage it must have required on his part. It says he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, evidently, he was being urged to stay there in that palace. He was tempted, no doubt, to enjoy those luxuries and pleasures of that Oriental palace. After all, he was a normal, red-blooded young man. Fleshly attractions surrounded him in that setting. He had access to every physical thrill, I suppose, that the evil world of his day could offer. Actually, he had every prospect before him to please a carnal heart. He was a crown prince. Nothing was being held back from him. I suppose Satan painted the temptations in their most vivid colors to allure him, to fascinate him and excite him. It must have seemed to Moses that this was the way to eternal fame and glory, to stay right there and become the next Pharaoh of Egypt. This was the way to perpetuate his name as the king of Egypt. He had no way of knowing, of course, that the very opposite was really true. You see, friends, I have visited the mummy room of the great Cairo Museum. I looked down the list of names of those who ruled over the ancient country of Egypt. Moses' name is not there. Do you know why, friends? Because Moses is no mummy. He's in heaven now. He was raised from the dead, according to the little book of Jude, and he's been in heaven now for many, many years. In the face of incredible opposition, he gave up a kingdom. He was a handsome young fellow, apparently. In Acts 7, 20 and 22, we read these words. In which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and in deed. Well, evidently he was talented, personable, and of course very intelligent. He had what every young person today dreams of having. And yet he chose to suffer affliction with God's people, esteeming the reproach for Christ as greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. Now consider this, friends. If reproach and humiliation in the cause of Christ can yield so much happiness, what will it be like to see Jesus face to face? What must be the joy of His unveiled glory if His humiliation and reproach can bring this kind of experience as it did to Moses? No wonder the Bible says, "Eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither hath entered the heart of man the things that God hath prepared for those who love Him." Now today, the name of Moses is on the tongue of multitudes of people. The Pharaohs, of course, are dead and forgotten. They died miserably, most of them, often without achieving any happiness at all in this life. The way of the transgressor is hard indeed. Now, it may not seem that way at the time temptation comes. The flesh may say, "Go ahead and enjoy yourself. Have a good time. Give way to your feelings." Oh, yes, impulse will urge us to enjoy the sensual pleasures that are always at hand. And Moses felt that physical craving and desire, but he also heard the voice of conscience and the voice of principle speaking. And he wisely subdued those passions and chose obedience to God rather than surrender to fleshly lust. If we could see Moses in heaven today, we would not think for a moment that he made a mistake in that choice. Now, Joseph had a similar experience also down in Egypt. Probably nobody faced any more severe physical tests than he did. Powerful emotion sought to capture his will, and Satan adorned the place and moment of that temptation with all the glamour and allure that could possibly be put in it. But again, the principle won out. And we're constantly faced by this same question, friends. Shall we live by impulse or principle? Shall we do what comes naturally, give way to feeling, please self? Or shall we follow principle, deny self, and use our will to do the right thing? Now let's think of a young man who did not win out. Jesus talked about him in that parable of the prodigal son. This young man came to the crossroads experience too. And Satan painted his delusive pictures with the same glamorous prospects of the flesh and the world. Moses and Joseph had faced it earlier. But again, that subtle appeal was made to freedom and of having one's own way. Listen, friends, the word freedom is one of the most misunderstood words in the English language. The devil has made capital out of it. The absolute freedom that the devil talks about is a pure figment of the imagination. Let's not even pretend that there's such a thing, because there isn't. The stars don't even have it. They're hemmed in by law. The ocean doesn't have it. It's also controlled by law. Man surely doesn't have it, because he's hemmed in by other men. How free, really, is a man in a modern city? He's only as free as the rights of his neighbor allow him to be. This attempt to find freedom without conscience always ends up in the same tragic way. The unforgettable story of the prodigal son, who took freedom and used it to enslave himself, is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Oh, yes, he walked down the road one Sunday morning with his young blood singing, "Don't fence me in." Nobody was going to tell him what to do and when to come in at night and how to spend his money. There'd be no rules, no stuffy religion to interfere with his rights. With a toss of his head, he left it all behind. Parental discipline, moral restraint, religion, responsibility, everything. Just a toss of his head and he was free. But listen, friends, free to do what? Free to do as he pleased? Free to follow self? This false freedom led him into perfect slavery. And the more he got what he wanted, the less he wanted what he got, and one day he ran smack into the truth of it. He saw that freedom is not merely a matter of rights, it's a matter of right. To act on rights as though there were no right or wrong is no liberty at all. It's just another form of slavery. Now, how many modern prodigals are drawn into the picture right here? Sin always begins with the assertion of rights. Yes, you have a right to choose. You can even choose to live for self if you want to. But you must understand this, that this is the most effective way to become a slave. When Jesus preached his first sermon, he said he had come to set the captives free. Yet the first step he made in the process was to bind them to himself. He said, "Follow me." Now, this is the great paradox of freedom, friends. We're never really free until we're bound, until we're voluntarily mastered by something greater than ourselves. The person is never really free in music until he's bound himself to that music. An artist is never free in painting. A person is never free in preaching or living a life until in heart and soul he is bound to that life. This is how true freedom is achieved. The freedom and happiness offered by Satan leads to the deepest slavery and misery. And the poor prodigal saw that at last, and he said, I'll arise and go to my father and say, I've sinned. Yes, he'd be glad to exchange his freedom for the place of a servant at home. Listen, I've talked to plenty of prodigals who were ready to do the same thing. Young men and young women who set out to rule their own lives, to do what they wanted to do. But finally, they came to themselves. The distinguished educator, Dr. Robert Fitz, said, young people today are losing control of their lives. They're having babies when they don't want them, getting married before they really want to, taking jobs before they're prepared for them. And this is the new freedom. Well, it reminds me of a young fellow in the academy who quit school. He said, I want to run my own life. I'm tired of being told what to do. I'm going to get a job and be my own boss. Well, he quit school and he got a job all right, digging ditches. And for the rest of his life, he'll have somebody telling him where to dig and when. Now, is this freedom, friends? What a laugh. What a hollow, tragic laugh. This mislabeled freedom is based on a false appeal, a counterfeit freedom. Scores of books have already been printed about it, assuring us that there are no absolute rules anymore. There are only impediments in the way of full development, and they're called rules. The idea is to get rid of these old ancient taboos and be your own self, be uninhibited. Religion is just a superstition whose puritanical laws create unnatural restraints. Oh, yes, friends, that's what you hear, and I'll tell you something. It's just a lovely dream, and it won't work. Why won't it work? For the simple reason that there is a law, a silent, invisible decree of nature that stands up in the road, shaking its head and saying, no, this is not the way of life. So long as we're merely dreaming the idea, of course, nature pays no attention. We could debate 100 falsehoods here. The earth is flat. 2 and 2 are 5. Moral restraints are unnecessary. And so long as we just stand discussing those things, nothing happens. But the moment we get on the road and begin to act upon those ideas, nature begins to pay attention. Something in the moral world, akin to gravity in the physical world, stands right up in the road saying, this is not the road to life, this is the road to death. Now we can heed the warning and push on past if we want to. Long ago, Mother Eve ignored that divine imperative. She trusted her emotions and feelings based upon sight. And in Genesis 3:6 it says, and when the woman saw that the fruit was good. Now listen, there are times when we must not even trust ourselves to look or linger. The longer we consider sin, the more demanding and reasonable it seems. If we argue with our emotions, we're going to lose strength of will over the thing. Our only safety is to flee from the devil's territory. Get off the enchanted ground of temptation. This is the only thing that spared Joseph. Some people think that maybe Joseph was cowardly. Why didn't he stay and correct the thinking of that woman? Obviously, her thoughts were going in wrong channels. Listen, he knew better than to argue with that attractive, seductive woman. He was wise enough to know that emotions can overpower the will. And if Eve had run away when she was tempted, the Bible would carry a different story today. But, of course, she didn't run away, and so we've had this problem of 6,000 years of sin. And now, this is Joe Cruz saying goodbye for today.